And the title for this segment, a split sermon after all, is Daniel and the Persians. Daniel and the Persians. So there's a new boss in town, and you know, when a new boss comes in, everything is up for grabs, isn't it? I mean, there are certain things that remain the same, but a lot of things, it's like, I have no idea what's going to happen. Anyone ever had a new boss? Good. I figured most of us had. Yeah, and it can be a little unnerving, right? Well, chapter 6 of Daniel is probably one of the most well-known stories in the Bible. This is Daniel and the lion's den. You've probably read it to your children. You might have had it read to you as a child. But you probably know this story. Now, the setting of this is the aftermath of the Persian conquest of Babylon. As I mentioned previously, Babylon fell to the armies of Persia. And a new government was going to be formed. And very likely, the events that we're reading about here in Daniel 6 took place within the first or second year, probably around 539 or 537 BC. Daniel, at this point, was over 80 years old, and God still had a few things for him to do. The kingdom of Persia was really the Medes and the Persians. It was a conglomerate, if you will. But the Persians were the dominant partner. Okay, even though it says Medes and Persians, it was actually the Persians and the Medes. And Darius, which we read about in the last verse of chapter 5, he's called a Mede, right? Darius the Mede. So I thought I'd take a minute to just explain this. He's identified as a Mede, not a Persian. So what about Cyrus? Wasn't Cyrus supposed to do all this stuff? You know, didn't Isaiah say Cyrus was going to be the man? Well, there are two ways to look at it without going into all the linguistics and the detail and the historical notes. There are two possible solutions. One is that this man, Darius, could have been a subordinate to Cyrus, because it's told to us that in later verses that Darius received the kingdom. So that's one possibility, that he received the kingdom as a subordinate of Cyrus, that he was a Mede. And the Medes were given jurisdiction over Babylon, that new part of the big growing Persian Empire. The other option is that Darius could have been a secondary name of Cyrus himself, which he would take on as the king, and it was a Median name, and he would do something like that possibly just to show, you know, I'm king of Persia and of Media. And people taking on ceremonial names is something that, you know, we don't see as much anymore, but like when the Pope comes along, you know, and maybe his name is Rupert Wengelschweitz, and he changes his name to Pope Benedict III. That's the sort of thing we're talking about. Okay? A regal name, if you will. Now let's pick it up here in Daniel 6 and read verses 1 through 5. It says, it pleased Darius to appoint 120 satraps to rule throughout the kingdom, with three administrators over them, one of whom was Daniel. So once again, I mean, Daniel's pulled out of mothballs, I guess, and he's given stuff to do because they see the worth of this man. And the satraps were made accountable to them so that the king might not suffer loss. So they were sort of accountants or controllers, if you will. Now Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. Clearly that means the jurisdiction of Babylon. And at this, the administrators and the satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. So they could find no corruption in him. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. And finally, these men said, We will never find any basis for charges against this man unless we dig in and attack him on religious grounds. As it says, unless it has something to do with the law of his God. So the other administrators were jealous. They saw this guy is going to be a, what? This guy's going to be appointed over us? No way. Let's find something in his religion that conflicts with our laws and make a big deal out of it and force Daniel to either obey God or the king. And we'll get him. Now, by what they're saying or proposing here, we can make two assumptions about Daniel. Oop, wrong slide. Did I turn it off? It's working. Oh, if I could get the next slide, it'd be great. Oh, that's the one. No, go forward. That's without a place. Nope, go forward again. Okay, that's the one I should have started with. Now go forward again. Okay. So, all right, good. All right, back. Okay, so now based on what these guys are saying, they said we're going to force Daniel. We're going to put him in a position where he is going to have to make some bad choices. So what does this say about Daniel and what they knew about Daniel? I mean, they observed him and they found a weakness. What was Daniel's great weakness in these guys' eyes? Well, one thing we know about what they said is that Daniel's religious convictions and his religious practices were public knowledge. They all knew who this guy was. They knew what he did. Things that he did were very outward, and they showed that he's a worshiper of Yahweh. So he wasn't hiding his spiritual life, hoping no one would notice. You know, maybe if I just keep it on the down low, I can just, you know, fly under the radar here in the government and not get into any trouble. That's not what Daniel was up to. Even in his comings and goings, he was a witness of God's way of life. The other thing I believe we can assume is that they knew that he would choose to obey Yahweh over the king. And that's why it was such a devious plan. We know this guy. He's committed to his God. He isn't going to want to do what the king says if it conflicts with his worship of this God. So his willingness to suffer loss for the sake of God was known. This guy was willing to put it on the line. So he had this public image, I guess. People knew this stuff about him. I think that says something to the way we conduct ourselves. You know, do we want to be, we want to just sort of like hide who we are? Or people wouldn't even know? You know, they don't even know that you're different. Well, Daniel's not like that. He's a good example for us. Well, let's pick it up in verse 6, though. It says, so the administrators and the satraps went as a group to the king, and they said, okay, may King Darius live forever. The royal administrators, prefects, satraps, advisors, and governors have all agreed that the king should issue an edict and enforce the decree that anyone who prays to any god or human being during the next 30 days, except to you, appealing to his vanity there a bit, right? Except to you, your majesty, shall be thrown into the lion's den. Now, your majesty, issue the decree and put it in writing. I don't know if you remember that old show, MASH, you know, where Radar would come in and he'd say, sign. And, you know, the chief of the camp would say, well, what is this? Just sign it. And he would do it every week. And he'd sign all these documents. I get that image here. Just, Darius, just, you know, sign the document. This is all good. Don't worry about the details. We'll work that out for you. This is going to make you look great. Now, Your Majesty, issue the decree and put it in writing so that it cannot be altered in accordance with the law of the Medes and the Persians. That was their motto. The law of the Medes and the Persians cannot be altered. So King Darius put the decree into writing. Now, the Persians as a whole, as a culture, as an empire, did not consider their kings to be deities. So this wasn't really, you know, Darius, you should be worshipped as the god. No, that's not what they were getting at. They were talking about someone who mediates between people and their god. That's how I think it needs to be understood, probably meaning that only Darius should act as a mediator to the gods, rather than people go directly to their god. This, I think, would fit into the Persians' whole political agenda, which was they were very tolerant and encouraging of different nationalities and different religions within the empire. That was their shtick. And they encouraged people to worship their own gods. This is going to work in Judah's favor, but it's a milieu. It's the kind of environment that they were in. The Persians just wanted to make sure that all this good, tolerant, good stuff happens within the overarching umbrella of Persian leadership, Persian government, Persian oversight. And I put it to you that it's another example of the quest for one world government, which has never, you know, it's always kind of there. Well, not always, but they're significant in human history. You can go back to the Tower of Babel, but here we're talking about Persia. What they wanted was, can't we just bring everybody in together and, you know, let's all put coexist bumpers on our cars, we'll drive around in Persia, and everything's going to be groovy. That's what they wanted. One world, one love. And it's nothing new. I mean, that was Babylon's dream too. I talked a little bit about it when we went through Babylon. That's what they were looking for. Just assimilate, become one of us. Let's just mush it all together and have a big party. Persians, that was their dream. The Hellenic Greeks who were gonna overthrow Persia, and we'll see this in Daniel's prophecy, that was their thing too. We just need one overarching culture. You can do your thing on Saturday, but you know, let's just have this big Hellenic culture. The Romans, that was their thing too. And all the successive versions of the Roman Empire that have come down over the millennia, that's the, you know, basic gist of it. One world government, and it makes a lot of sense. But it also comes with some strings attached. That's the problem, right? The dream lives on. So let's pick it up in verse 10. Where are we? Verse 10 says, now, Daniel learned that this decree had been published. And what did he do? He went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened towards Jerusalem. And three times a day, he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God, just as he had done before. So no break in his continuity. Then these men, the ones who had set this whole trap up, went as a group and found Daniel praying and asking God for help. Clear violation of the law. So they went to the king and they spoke to him about his royal decree. You can hear the craftiness, I think, in their voice. King, did you not publish a decree that during the next 30 days, anyone who prays to any god or human being except you, Your Majesty, would be thrown into the lion's den? And the king answers, the decree stands. Yes, of course, in accordance with the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be repealed. Yes. Sucker. So Daniel had specifically defied a law of the land. Bad, 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 Daniel. All right, you know where we got to go now. Go to Romans 13, verse 1 through 2. Defying laws of the land. Romans 13, verse 1, verse 2 says, "Let everyone be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established." I mean, God put Cyrus where he was. The authorities that exist have been established by God, both good and evil. Consequently, whoever rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted, and those who do so will bring judgment upon themselves. That puts us in a bit of a pickle sometimes, doesn't it? I mean, I think we're pretty well off in the United States at this point, but be ready. Things can change at the drop of a hat. Go to Acts 5, verse 29. And this is a scenario in the book of Acts where the apostles are going out and they're preaching Christ. And the Jewish authorities say, "You guys are breaking our law. We told you not to preach about Christ. Stop it. Obey the law." You can read the rest of the chapter and see that's what it says. And Peter and the other apostles replied to them, "We must obey God rather than human beings." So there's your out, right? But be careful. Be careful. And don't use that way out that God gives you to do stuff that God's not pleased with. Now, when we think about this dilemma, if you will, we usually think about rejecting government regulations that order us to either disregard God's laws or disobey them, right? That's usually the scenario we think of. You know, don't keep the Sabbath, or don't, you know, you may not go to the holy days, or whatever. Okay, any of the commandments would suffice. Daniel's situation is a little different, because Daniel's rejection of this government regulation is not a matter of transgressing a law, God's law. It's about performance of what is pleasing to God. Daniel could have reasoned his way out of this, I think. He could have said, "Well, you know, there's no actual commandment that says I have to pray, you know, all the time, every day. I don't, you know, there's no commandment that says that, right? So maybe I'll just take a break. I'll take a break for 30 days, you know, no harm, no foul, not a commandment anyway. I'll just stop for 30 days until this whole thing blows over, alrighty?" But he didn't do that, did he? He did not do that. He continued to worship God. So it wasn't just a matter of, you know, obeying a commandment. So the whole interaction that we have with government, laws, the higher law, is complicated and requires faith and discernment. Hopefully you get that in big measure through God's Spirit. Let's go on, though, with the record we've got here. What's happening here? It's a trap, right? These guys set a trap. And it's a trap based on legalism. Let's read verses 12 through 16. So the king answers, "Yes, the decree stands in accordance with the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be repealed." He's very proud of this. And then they said to the king, "Okay, now this Daniel guy, this Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, who, you know, you're thinking of promoting him over all of us, he pays no attention to you, your majesty, or to the decree which you put in writing, and he still prays three times a day." Gotcha. And when the king heard this, he was greatly distressed, because he liked Daniel, obviously, well, you know. He thought he was a great part of the administration, but I think he actually liked this guy. And he was determined to rescue Daniel, and he made every effort until sundown to save him, because the clock was ticking. So basically what he's going through, he's combing through all the laws to see if there's some loophole. How can I save this guy? There's got to be a way. There's got to be a legal way out of this. Then the, where was I? Verse 16. So yeah. Then the men went as a group to King Darius, and they said to him, "Now remember," this is probably the time's up, "remember, your majesty, that according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, no decree or edict that the king issues can be changed." So the king gave the order, and they brought Daniel, and they threw him into the lion's den. And the king said to Daniel, "May your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you." He was concerned for this man, Daniel, that he liked. He liked Daniel, but the king was caught in a trap. Caught in a trap. Yeah, he's caught in a trap. Caught in a trap, and it's a legal trap, right? And he desperately looks for some legal loophole, but he can't find one. The administrators and the satraps remind him of Persian legal philosophy. The law of the Medes and the Persians cannot be altered or passed over. This unbreakable law. Now, on one hand, this approach looks good, doesn't it? Law's the law. People should obey the law. No person should be above the law. Just because Darius likes Daniel shouldn't be any reason for him to override the law, should it? Do you like that when you see that in American law? When you see someone getting away with stuff because they're connected? People like them? No, you do not. So there's a certain appeal to this, isn't there? The law is the law, and it can't be changed on the personal whim of the king. So this is your, what I'm going to call your basic rule of law thinking. And it's there in my head, and I bet it's in your head too. People should obey the law. But on the other hand, this same scenario shows a weakness. It shows the weakness of ruling with a rod of iron. There is a weakness. If you rule with a rod of iron, but you have no mercy, things can go badly. Now, we often think, when we think of our lives, and we think of training to be kings and priests, to serve with Christ in his administration of God's will on earth, usually, you know, a very simplistic way of looking at it is that we learn God's law and we're thinking, well, how will we enforce these in the millennial rule? And that's what's coming next in God's plan. You know, it's a very simplified way of looking at it. Right? That's kind of how we look at it. God's laws are right and just. There should be no problem here. Law's the law. Everyone should obey it. You break the law, boom. Right? But God says in no uncertain terms, I desire mercy. Go to James 2. There just aren't any easy answers with this God of ours. James 2, verse 12. Speak and act as those who are going to be judged by the law that gives freedom. Because judgment without mercy will be shown to anyone who has not been merciful. And here's the key phrase to zoom in on. Mercy triumphs over judgment. God's desire for you and me is that you learn to judge based on righteous principles, his law, which is holy, just, and good. But that you also learn to administer it, meet it out to people, however you get those opportunities in your life, with mercy. Right? That's what the scriptures say. Now, like the Medes and the Persians, you know, the law of the Medes and Persians cannot be put aside. I put it to you that God's law is the same way, isn't it? Can you put God's law aside and say, well, it doesn't matter. I really like this person, so I want to do things this way. God's law, in some ways, is the same. God's law cannot be set aside or changed based on our own personal feelings and whims. So Darius likes Daniel, but he's trapped. His feelings, he's in a conflict. How does God work out stuff like this? Can God work out stuff like this? Yes, he can. God can accomplish both goals through the life and death and the resurrection of Christ. Through Christ, all kinds of stuff gets accomplished at the same stroke. The law is upheld. God is righteous. The penalty for sin is paid. This happens through Christ. The law is upheld. But also in Christ, mercy is applied. Mercy is applied. God can act graciously towards you. God is merciful. And three, you live. Because of this, you live. God gives you life. It says in Romans 3 that God is both he's righteous, he's just, and the justifier. He makes the rule of law happens. It is not passed over in the sense that we ignore it. It's fulfilled. But mercy is also applied. This comes to us through Christ. And this is how God works it out. Now, as we walk through our lives, it's important for us to balance these things. And I'm not going to give you the verdict in every case. You have to work those things through. And that's what God wants you to learn. Mercy and judgment. If you think about it, though, if you don't have righteous judgment, if you don't have laws, and you don't have righteous judgment, you really don't have mercy either. Mercy only can be applied when there's a problem, when there's a law that's broken, and there's someone who's going to suffer. Otherwise, mercy is just good vibrations. Be careful, though. Be careful how you administer mercy. God wants righteous judgment, and he wants mercy. Okay, let's move on with the story. Bing. Okay. Because there's cool stuff happening here. Let's take a look at verse 17, and I'm going to read actually through the end of the chapter here. It says, a stone was brought and was placed over the mouth of this lion's den, and the king sealed it with his signet ring and with the signet ring of his nobles so that Daniel's situation might not be changed. No hope for him. Then the king returned to his palace, and he spent the night without eating and without entertainment that was being brought to him, and he couldn't sleep. He was, he was upset. And at the first light of dawn, the king got up and he hurried to the lion's den. And when he came near to the den, he called out to Daniel in an anguished voice, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions? And Daniel answered, may the king live forever. My God has sent his angel, and he shut up the mouths of the lions, and they have not hurt me because I was found innocent in his sight. Nor have I done anything wrong before you, your majesty. And the king was overjoyed, and he gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. And when Daniel was lifted from the den, no wound was found on him because he had trusted his God. And at the king's command, the men who had falsely accused Daniel were brought in and thrown into the lion's den, along with their wives and children. In some ways, that's the Old Testament way of dealing with false accusers. Let him who falsely accuses suffer the penalty of the law which they accuse the other of. And before reaching the floor of the den, the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. Then King Darius wrote to all the nations. This is very interesting. King Darius wrote something to all the nations and peoples of every language over all the earth. May you prosper greatly. I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, and he endures forever, and his kingdom will not be destroyed, and his dominion will never end. He rescues, he saves, he performs signs and wonders in the heavens and the earth, and he has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions. So Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus, the Persian. So notice that Darius issues a decree, once again giving legal protection to all those who worship Yahweh. We saw this in Babylon as well. If you were there for that message, it was a couple months ago. Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon had issued a similar decree protecting the religious observance and worship of the Jewish exiles directed towards him, towards Yahweh. But Babylon was gone now. And there was a new boss in town, new laws, no remembrance of the laws of Babylon or why they were enacted. And through Daniel, the true and living God maneuvered Darius into encoding the same religious protections for them all over again. This incident, this last record of Daniel's exploits in the courts of the kings, because after this we don't hear any more about like what happens in his life. We do have prophecies, but this is the end of Daniel's story. After this last incident, it sets the stage for what's yet to come. The Persian kings have a very good relationship with the Jewish exiles. And it kind of starts here with Daniel and this decree. And they seem very positive towards the Jews, and through Persia, the great living God will return the people to the land as prophesied at the appointed time. Go to Ezra 1. Ezra 1. Verse 1 through 4. In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah, the Lord moved the heart of Cyrus, king of Persia, to make a proclamation throughout his realm and also to put it in writing. This is what Cyrus, king of Persia, says. The Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has appointed me to build a temple for him at Jerusalem in Judah. Any of his people among you may go up to Jerusalem in Judah and build the temple of the Lord, the God of Israel, the God who is in Jerusalem. And may their God be with them. And in any locality where survivors may now be living, the people are to provide for them with silver and gold, with goods and livestock, and with freewill offerings for the temple of God in Jerusalem. So as prophesied by Isaiah, Jeremiah, Daniel, the king that topples Babylon will set in motion the restoration of the exiles to the promised land and the rebuilding of Jerusalem. We're in Ezra 1. Drop down to verse 7. Nice little bookend here for today's message. It says, in addition, King Cyrus brought out the articles belonging to the temple of the Lord, which Nebuchadnezzar had carried away from Jerusalem and placed in the temple of his God. And Cyrus, king of Persia, had them brought by Mithridat, the treasurer, and counted them out to Sheshbazzar, the prince of Judah. And then they go through the inventory. And it says, all in all, there were 5,400 articles of gold and silver, and Sheshbazzar brought all these along with the exiles when they came up from Babylon to Jerusalem. So Cyrus, in addition to all this, kind of fixes things here a bit. All those articles were returned to Jerusalem. The same drinking vessels, goblets, stuff, and other items that Belshazzar had used to insult and blaspheme Yahweh. And they all end up going back to Jerusalem as prophesied.